Hello and welcome to a response of the day for the 19th day of Adar Sheni. Today we're going to see a response of Natan Gestetner in Shut Lahorot Natan, an important Rav in the 20th century in Yerushalayim. And the question is from Chelek Vav, Part 6, Simon Kufchav Vav. Response number 126, and it's dated the 19th day of Adar Sheni of Tufshin Mem Vav of 1986. Question is the following. A man buys an apartment, or a person buys an apartment, I think it was a man, buys an apartment, and there are mezuzot on the doors. So the seller leaves the mezuzot. Now, those mezuzot were written in a certain kind of script known as the Ktav of the Arizal. That's one kind of a Hebrew script. And the purchaser removes the mezuzot, at least the scrolls, and he switches them with mezuzot written in the Ktav Beit Yosef, in a Sephardi kind of script that followed the version of Rav Yosef Karo, the author of Shulchan Aruch and Beit Yosef and Kesef Mishneh. Now the seller said nothing about the mezuzot during the course of the sale, but once he heard that the guy had taken them down, he said he wanted them, and he wants the purchaser to return to him the mezuzot or to pay for them. Obviously, the purchaser doesn't want to. The question is, what do you do about that? Rav Gestetner points out that in Choshen Mishpat 2:14, paragraph 1, the Shulchan Aruch rules that if somebody sells a bayit, a house, there's the house sale. Now, this is one of those interesting areas of halacha, I think, that people don't notice so much, is that halacha will prescribe what is or isn't included in a sale, even though it's very clear that if the participants in a sale want to make different conditions for themselves, they can. This is not the halacha saying this is what should happen. It's saying this is our presumption about what does happen. So the presumption is, unless something said otherwise, the presumption is that somebody who sells a house has sold all of the fixed parts of the house. Adrim ha-kivu'im. All things fixed in the house. So that would be things like the doorways, right? The doors, right? You wouldn't think that when you buy an apartment or buy a house, you come in and the guy says, oh, no, I meant to take the doors with me. So the halacha is that, right, because those are attached to the house. Today, I think, at least in American law, I think they make clear that all these things are true. But in halacha, this was the assumption that was made, even if it wasn't said to be true. That all that is fixed to the house is considered part of the house, and therefore the sale includes that. Then the Ramah adds there, v'yesh amrim d'chibur b'yitaydot lo mikrei chibur. Some people say that which is nailed on to the house doesn't count. So what are the things that are nailed onto the house? Well, mezuzot are going to be one thing, because many people nail their mezuzot into the doorpost. So are mezuzot included in that or not is the question. So that's an issue as to whether we include that which is fastened by, that's nailed on. But that could be true of certain, you know, paintings, maybe, depending on how you fix them to the wall. You could say, oh, they're attached. The buyer might say, oh, they're attached. And the seller would say, no, they're not. And unless it was dealt with clearly in their contract of sale, you'd have to talk about this. And that was not an issue that was absolutely clear. The Gemara in Bava Batra raised the question, and it never came to a conclusion about that question. So they rule that it's not... so it seems like they rule that it's not sold with it, like any teku of mamon, meaning that if the Gemara raises a question, it doesn't come to an answer to it, that's what we mean by teku. A question that's left unresolved in the Gemara, and it's a money issue, so we generally say that the person who is trying to get that money has a problem because he can't prove or she can't prove that they are owed that money. So if I'm selling a house so the easy example would be, I'm selling a house to somebody, and as I sell it, I take something with me. And the buyer wants to say, I didn't have the right to take that with me. So if it was an item that was nailed onto the walls, and the buyer says, I of course assume that I would get it because it's nailed to the wall, and I say, nailed to the wall doesn't count as part of the house. It's the fixed stuff that's part of the house. So the buyer cannot prove me wrong. So in cases of money, if the person who wants something from somebody else can't prove them wrong, then they can't get it, because they can only get it if they can prove it. That's how motzi mechavero alav haraya. That if somebody wants to extract money from somebody else, it's the person making the claim who has to prove that claim. Well, often you can prove a claim, but this will be an unprovable claim. If that were true, then when it comes to mezuzot that are nailed to the wall, it would seem that they are assumed to be, halakhically, in the ownership of the seller, by which Rav Gestetner means that if the seller were to take them down and take them with him, the buyer would not be able to claim that he stole something of his, because the buyer can't prove that, because this is an unresolved question in the Gemara. And he would have to prove it. He can't. The reason that's not cut and dry, though, is that there's another halacha that's quoted in Pirkei Tshuva there, based on Shut Shivat Zion. So Shut Shivat Zion is a book of response written by Rav Shmuel Landau, the son of Rav Yechezkel Landau, who was the Noda Behuda and the Tzlach and the Dagom Rivava, who was an important Achron. His son, Rav Shmuel Landau, who succeeded him in the rabbinate in Prague, wrote a sefer called Shivat Zion. And there, in Shivat Zion, he pointed out that in Yeridea, so Kosher Mishpat, which is where we started, is about monetary law. So as a money question, as a question of contracts and assumptions in contracts of who owns what in the sale of a house, that's what we've been discussing till now. In Yeridea, which is about what's called Isur V'Heter, prohibitions and permissions. It's about ritual law more. So that's where you're going to find the laws of how to write a Sefer Torah. That's where you're going to find the laws of Kashrus, the laws of Nida, the laws of how we deal with idolatry. It's all these laws about sort of ritual issues that come up that aren't about Jews as people. They're about Jews as servants of Hashem and following, you know, halachot that are specific to that. So there, the Shulchan Aruch Paskins in Yeridea, in Reish Sadi Aleph, in 291, paragraph 2, that if somebody rents a house, and when they got to the house, there were no mezuzot. When they rented the house, they put up mezuzot. They have to put up mezuzot, right? Why do they have to put up mezuzot? Because you can't live in a house with mezuzot. So you might have thought, that's halacha, it's important to know, because you might have thought that as a renter, it's not your house and you're not required to. The answer is, it's a chovat hadar. The person living there has to put up mezuzot. But the Shulchan Aruch Paskins, the renter cannot then take the mezuzot with him when he leaves. Now, you might have thought he should be able to, because after all, he put them up. So you think they're his. Now, this is not, again, this is not a yored, this is not a choshen mishpat issue. This is not a claim that this is what's right. Monetary halacha. It's not a monetary requirement to leave it there. It's a yoredei requirement, meaning this is a house that otherwise would not have mezuzot. You've put up mezuzot. You're not allowed to restore it to being. Now, if the owners were non-Jews, you would be allowed to take it with you. If you knew that the new renters wouldn't be Jews either. But that's the issue we're talking about here. You don't want to leave the house with no mezuzot when it should have mezuzot. But there are more rights there that even if that's true, you can't take the mezuzot with you. But you can demand money from the second one, meaning you can say to the guy who's coming after you, which is the owner or a new renter, you can say, I put up mezuzot, you got to pay me for them, and if not, I'm taking them with me. So the financial aspect of it seems to reside with the person who put up the mezuzot. Coming back to our case now, so it's true that we think that the person who sold it had the rights to those mezuzot because they were only fixed with nails, but he wouldn't have been able to keep them. So maybe he's not a muhzak. Maybe he's not the person, meaning Rav Gesetner is trying to establish who is the person who's in legal possession of these mezuzot, because the other person will be stuck needing to prove something that he can't prove. So the first step was, maybe you'd say, well, they're fastened with nails, so that seems like they were in the possession of the seller at the time of the sale. That seems to mean that it's the burden of the buyer to prove that he should have to leave them as a financial matter. But with mezuzot, you might argue, he wasn't allowed to take them with him, not because of the yitidot issue, the having been affixed with nails issue, but because the yoredei issue, that you're not allowed to take mezuzot with you. So that would seem to imply that the presumption of halacha is that they stay in the house, and then so that means the seller is the one who's stuck. And if he wants to claim that he should get them, he seems to have to be the one to prove that he should have the right to get them. And even then, he wouldn't be able to get them, because as we said, it seems like you'll have to leave them. So we haven't gotten to yet. Let's keep in mind that the buyer took them down. So we'll get to there. But what he's saying is the most that the seller should have is a financial claim, just like we saw in Yoredei. The Ramah says that you can demand the money for it. And if that's true, then it means that the lokeach is the one in legal possession. He's the muhzak. He's the one with legal presumption of ownership. It could be disproven, but he's the one with the presumption. And therefore, we can't require him to give them back for the same reason that would have been true the other way around. So that's all the analysis of the Shivat Zion. So the Gestetner is not sure, right? So let's, again, very briefly review. The Shivat Zion's claim was that while it's true that as a financial matter you would think that the seller is in legal halachic possession, is the muhzak, and therefore the buyer should be the one who has to prove that he gets to keep the mezuzot, and because of the yitzidot, because they were fastened to the walls, that you would have thought that that would have meant the seller's the one on top with a legal claim. But the problem is that no, that since Yoridei HaLachas is that the seller has to leave the mezuzot, not because they're fixed to the wall, and not because it's part of the assumed sale of a house, but because of a different issue that we don't want to leave houses and apartments without mezuzot on them. So that destroys that, and that seems to put the lokeach, the buyer, in legal control. It would be up to the seller to prove otherwise. So Rav Gestetner says, I'm not sure that's true, because let's remember that as a matter of financial law, of dinei mamanon, the seller would be able to take it. If he took it with him, what could the buyer claim? The buyer couldn't claim anything, because the buyer would say, well, they were fastened to the walls. So the seller would say, that's an unresolved issue in the Gemara. I assume that the answer is that things only fastened to the walls with nails are not part of the permanent part of the house, and I'm allowed to take them with me. So is he going to claim you're not allowed to because of your Yoridea? So Rav Gestetner says, but that's what's called an Isur Gavra. That's a personal obligation of the seller. It's true. Halakhically, he's a bad guy if he takes the mezuzot. But the bad guy part of taking the mezuzot is not a right of the buyer. It's just an obligation of the seller. So if the seller wants to violate what he should do, the buyer can't do anything about it. He has no way to, he has no legal recourse. It's not like he can go to a Beit Din and say to the Beit Din, he's supposed to leave the mezuzot, force him to leave the mezuzot. As a financial matter, now sometimes, but they did force Jews to keep the Torah because they forced Jews to keep the Torah. That might not have been the best example, but as a financial legal issue, he doesn't have any claim to it. If that's true, says Rav Gestetner, then why shouldn't he be considered the legal owner, the mukzak? And then that would mean, again, we would consider him the legal owner, the mukzak, because he's the one who has the right and the ability to take them with him. And then that would mean that that now he should have the prior claim to them. So the Rav Gestetner points out there's a Tosfot in Sukkah that says that even though we're talking about, I think, hadassim, even though one is not allowed to take out, the way that hadassim actually grow is they have these little bulbs in them, or sometimes they do, and so those aren't supposed to be there when you shake it as part of a lulav, but you're not allowed to take them off over Yom Tov. But and then that might render them invalid. But Tosfos would say it's still considered biyado l'takein. It's not considered that they are permanently not able to be fixed. And then if you could fix it, sometimes halakhically you're allowed to pretend that it is fixed and to use it anyway, right? It's a principle called kolaroy lepila ein bila ma'akevipo. If it's able to do something, in halakha sometimes, very often, if it's able to have something happen to it, even if it doesn't actually happen, that halakhically we won't care about that. So the prime example is when it came to flour offerings, the Beit HaMikdash, so there were flour offerings that had to be able to be mixed with oil, and if they couldn't, because there was too much flour for the oil to get to it, then you wouldn't be able to offer it that way. But if they could be, theoretically, even if it actually wasn't mixed together with the oil, that wouldn't invalidate the thing. So that creates the principle of kolaro oy lebila, ein bila me'akevibo. If it's able to do something, if it's possible to do something, then that actual thing doesn't actually need to necessarily happen in order for it to be a valid thing. So here too, with the hadassim, the Tosfos is pointing out that we can consider hadassim to be appropriate for use of hadassim, even though they have these bulbs, these anavim, these grapeish kinds of things that ordinarily would invalidate them, and even though on Yom Tov you're actually not allowed halakhically to remove them, we consider them removable because, and this is why it's important to Rav Gestetner's point, because if the person wanted to violate Yom Tov, he would have, and he could have, and that still, and that qualifies. Not that we're encouraging him to, but that qualifies to be considered removable. So Rav Gestetner's saying, you see, that which is prohibited is nonetheless considered to be, in many cases, within one's power. Then he points out that might be actually be a machloket. It seems to him that it's a machloket of Rashi and Tosfot in Chulin on Dalet Amid Bet, where there's a debate between Rashi and Tosfot, where Rashi says that chilufei isur hana'ah shel chametz on Pesach, then it couldn't possibly be that you're allowed to sell them to somebody else, because if you could sell them to somebody else, then they would have to have monetary value. And we have a mission that says that truma of chametz on Pesach, so chametz is leavened bread. So if you have wheat that was supposed to be truma, it was turned into bread, leavened bread, it's not allowed to be eaten on Pesach. So we say that if somebody eats it on Pesach, either will either deliberately or not deliberately, probably not deliberately because if deliberately they are liable for punishment, they did not deliberately, they also don't have to pay it back to the original Kohen. Why not? Because we say that stuff has no monetary value. But Rashi says, but if it was possible to sell it to a non-Jew, not permitted. If it was that we would say that you can do that and it takes effect and it works. No, I'm sorry. If we say you could do it, he says, the money can't be permissible. This is what Rashi says. The money cannot be permissible to the person who does so, because if it was permissible, then we would say that it has monetary value, and the Mishnah is making clear that it doesn't, because if it had monetary value, then the person who eats it by accident should have to repay the owner the monetary value. That's the way Rashi says it there, and Tosafot says that's not a good inference, because it could be that even if the money is permissible, since it's not allowed to be done, it doesn't count as money. So that's the exact debate Rav Gestern is pointing out. That's the exact debate we're having here. If I say there's some monetary value that could be captured, but only by violating a prohibition of the Torah, is that considered monetary value or not? Rashi seems to say that it is, right? Rashi seems to say that it is, that if the money is usable once you've sold the chametz, even though you're not allowed to sell the chametz, if we say the money is usable, Rashi says that would count as monetary value, which means that if you can do something to capture monetary value, even by violating the Torah, that counts as monetary value. And Tosafot says not. So that's the exact issue here. Do we consider, so the Rav Gestern is saying, that's the issue that I would want to raise in response to the Shivat Zion. Shivat Zion said that since the seller or the person who originally rented, but in our case, the seller could not halakhically have taken the mezuzot down, that makes him no longer a muhzak, the owner of record, the presumed owner of those mezuzot. And then if there arises a question as to who has the financial right to them, so then he's no longer the one in the lead seat on that question. That's what the Shivat Zion had said. And Rav Gestern said he thinks that's an open question, and maybe it's a debate among Rishonim as to whether somebody could capture some monetary value, could gain some monetary value by violating the Torah. Does that count as being a muhzak or no, as being the presumed owner or not? But, coming back to our issue, that was all only true until when? Until the sale happened. But in our case, if you remember, the buyer purchased the apartment, moved into the apartment, took it over, and now is the one who's holding on to the mezuzot. Now is the one who is in possession of those mezuzot. So that would seem to be that it takes us back to that question of, does the sale inherently include that which is fastened to the walls or not? So if it doesn't inherently include it, then the lokeach moving in shouldn't affect us. But if it does, then the lokeach moving in means that it's now his. And then that means that since that question is unresolved, as we said before, and it's a teiku, so then now the lokeach is the one who's got the presumption because he's the one who's in the apartment. So if Gestetner points out that the Shach wrote a sefer called, wrote a book called Tukfo Koin, a very important, well-recognized sefer. And Tukfo Koin, the Shach discusses issues like this, issues of what happens when one party just grabs something and demands it at his right. What are the times when somebody can make a grab at it and it has halachic standing? So he talks there a lot about whether if there's a teiku in an issue in halacha, meaning the Gemara leaves it unresolved, and therefore we shouldn't leave it unresolved, if one of the parties to a dispute just grabs the money in question, how does that work? Many authorities happen to assume that it works, it's effective. Not good, maybe, but it's effective. And I have to say, I would think that Batei Din would then come along and say, you know what, we don't like this because it's going to lead to a sort of a Wild West kind of version of Jewish life. And I would think they would come along and make local rules, which are always in the rights of local Batei Din to do, to say we're not going to allow this. But as a matter of pure halacha, in the absence of any other legislation, many authorities held that this would be effective, and that would mean that this lokeach, the buyer, is now in possession of these mezuzot, and he doesn't have to pay or return the mezuzot. But then Rav Gestern says, but he thinks maybe even according to the Oz who say that it doesn't work, that tfisa, grabbing, doesn't help. So the Shach writes that since this is an unresolved issue, he thinks that the judges have to figure it out. The judges have to look at the case. They have to hear the claims in the case. They have to come to their best reasonable judgment, meaning there's no proofs here. There's their best reasonable judgment about where that money should reside. But coming back to our case now, so it's true maybe that tfisa does or doesn't doesn't work, but that's tfisa. That's where the person who's grabbing it grabbed it grabbed it without any right to grab it, without any assumption that he could do it. He just grabbed it. And then it's a halakha question, meaning I'm sitting there one day, I have this money. It's true, this is money that is debated, as a subject of debate in the Gemara, but I'm also the only guy. The guy walks up to me, grabs it from me, and walks away. Right? That's the case that the Shach is talking about, of tukfa, grabbed it. And then it's unclear sometimes, even though the person, it looks bad, but he's saying, no, I think legally it's mine. So I think I'm just taking what's mine. So that's not so clear in halacha as to how to handle that. But in our case, what's different is he was tafas birishut. Everybody agrees that the seller gave him over the apartment and left the mezuzot there, and the guy got it. So there, a tfisa birishut, everybody agrees, should work because the seller agreed to it. That's what Rav Gestetner is saying. And therefore, it would seem like tafas birishut, he grabbed it, he took it, but he took it with the permission of the other person. And that should establish a legal claim according to all opinions. And Rav Gestetner says that there, he thinks already, the Shivat Zion's logic works perfectly, right? The fact that there's some reason why the seller felt obligated to leave it, even if that's a yoreder reason, so it's not really a financial reason, but it's a reason. As long as the seller felt obligated to leave it and decided to leave it of his own, not free will, but his own understanding of his responsibilities, then when the lokeach owns it, that's a tfisa that was birishut, and therefore it should have the effect of making the lokeach, the buyer, the legal person of record on this item. Now it is true that there's an opinion of the Shi'iltot, quoted by Tosfot, that if the person who's currently in possession of the house, either the seller or the person who had been renting it for a certain time and was now moving out, then he put up mezuzot and he wants to use those mezuzot somewhere else, so the Shi'iltot felt the buyer could, that person could then take it with him. Meaning, when the halacha says that the people leaving a house have to leave the mezuzot, it didn't mean they always have to leave the mezuzot. It meant they don't need them for anything, and the people coming in need mezuzot because they're going to be living in this house, then you should leave it. But if you have some other need for it, the Shi'iltot felt that you could take them with you. But that opinion, Rav Gestetner points out, is not quoted in Yoredeya. And all that Yoredeya quotes, that the Beit Yosef quotes in Yoredeya, he quotes a different Tosfot, which says that you shouldn't take them even if for a brief period of time because of, and this gets to topics that we can get into right now, but because of, you know, mazikin, demons, or destructive forces come into homes that don't have a mezuzah on them. So if that's true, then you can't take it. And many authorities came to view that you can't take it, that Shi'iltot aside. And if so, then you really can't take it. But that's not our case either. Because in our case, the seller didn't seem to have any particular need for them because he left without saying anything about it. Now, Gestetner points out that in another case, it would be clear that the person who's now in possession of the apartment would have to return the mezuzot. Because the halakha in Shulchan Aruch was talking about, I said before, renters. So imagine if renter A comes to the apartment, puts up mezuzot, and is leaving, but renter B is going to be moving in. So the halacha is he has to leave the mezuzot there for renter B. But let's suppose that renter B decided that he didn't want those mezuzot, he wanted other mezuzot. So because it says everybody would understand that renter B then has to return the mezuzot to renter A. There's no, because let's remember that renter B is not actually buying the apartment, he's moving in. So there's no reason to think that the apartment acquired those mezuzot. If renter B wants to put up other mezuzot, then it obviously belongs to renter A. So that throws us back into the question of when the seller sold the house, sold the apartment to the buyer, did he or did he not mean to include him? That gets back into all the questions we've done before about the financial arrangements there. And then Rav Gestetner says, and here I think already is what to think about, he thinks that the buyer has become the mukzak, the presumed owner, so we can't remove it from him without any proof of it. We don't have any proof. But not only that, he says, I think there's a good umdana, there's a good presumption that the seller meant to sell the mezuzot. Why? See, this is what he writes. Sharei lo bikesh lo et hamezuzot velo et dimehen ela achar shehakone horidan. He didn't ask for money, and he didn't ask for the mezuzot until the buyer took them down. So because it says if he had wanted them at all, it's true, he couldn't have gotten them themselves because of the halacha in Yoredeya that we've discussed, but he should have asked for the money. And since he didn't ask for the money, says Gestetner, it seems clear that he meant to sell them. So I think that's a very difficult claim. And this gets into a topic that bothers me greatly and comes up, I think, in many places in halacha, where people who don't know halacha or know a little bit of halacha can sometimes find themselves at a distinct disadvantage because the halacha will say to them, well, you should have said X or Y or Z, but they hadn't at all realized they could say X or Y or Z. Meaning, here, the man's selling an apartment. I think it's probably true that he understood that he was required to leave the mezuzot, as is true and correct. So you could say, well, he could have gotten the money for it. But in fact, he didn't care about the money, perhaps. Right? But when the buyer took down the mezuzot, he could have, meaning, let's suppose these were mezuzot of sentimental value in his family. So he finds himself in this terrible situation. He's selling an apartment. He's going to lose the mezuzot. It's upsetting, but that's the way it goes sometimes in life. Balach and Yaradeh is, you have to leave the mezuzot. He leaves the mezuzot. Oh, he should have asked for the money. These weren't a monetary issue, right? The mezuzot were worth $1,000. That $1,000 happened not to bother him that much. He didn't feel like he'd gotten, you know, enough of a good price in the apartment. He didn't feel like nitpicking over that money. I can fully understand how that happens. Then when the buyer takes down the mezuzot because he wants a different kind of mezuzot on his doors, he says, oh, so if you don't want them, give them to me. So Rav Gestetner's idea, I'm not like arguing him on halacha, but his idea that the buyer's not having said anything prejudices us to understand that the buyer didn't care about it, that I find hard to understand. I think it's, to me, I would have argued the other way. I would have argued that since the halacha in Yoredeya prevents the seller from selling them, from keeping them, he didn't bother saying anything about it. And then the question is, so does that mean anything? So then you get into questions of presumption, etc. And I'm not saying which way it cuts. I'm just saying this last argument to me feels problematic. And then the truth is, it feels to me that since it was only Halacha and Yoredeya that made him do it, it shouldn't necessarily switch any presumption of ownership in terms of what was meant to the original sale. And then you could have this whole argument. So I'm not sure that I'm convinced by that element of Rav Gestetner's reasoning. But the reasoning itself helps us think about a nice, interesting halachic issue when it comes to money and presumptions of money and how sales do and don't work. Now, he closes by pointing out another important point that he makes, that he's writing all of this as a pilpul. By pilpul, he means thinking about it. Let's think about this together. It's an interesting issue. You brought it up. Good. We'll think about it. But it's a monetary issue. He says, I couldn't possibly rule on it unless the two parties come to argue in front of me. Why not? Because they might have claims that weren't included in the question. That's something we've seen before as well, that whenever somebody writes a letter about a monetary issue that comes before him, right, and somebody sends him a question, they'll always be caught, or often be very cautious to say, I can't rule on this, because you can't rule on monetary issues unless the parties are right there in front of you, because they may have claims that weren't well articulated in the original discussion. So that's true here as well. And Rav Gestetner, Lahor Natan, for the 19th day of Adar Sheni, teaches us about assumptions in houses and sales of houses, assumptions about mezuzot, how mezuzot are both objects in a house as well as items of mitzvah, and therefore come up with certain rules about that. And all of that affects the question of who gets to keep the mezuzot if they've been taken down after a sale. With thanks to the OU, to Rabbi Jack Abramowitz, to David Hakhauser, for their help in making this shiurim available to you. This is Gideon Rothstein with the response of the day for the 19th day of Adar Sheni. Have a great day.